Good afternoon. Thank you very much for hanging on. I hope I don't disappoint you. I want to put up first this cartoon of Darwin. It's kind of a dream of mine. If you don't think he was into entomology and beetle collecting, if somebody draws a cartoon of you doing that, you know he was really into it. Again, this is kind of a dream of mine, and I want to thank Gene first, and you got to like somebody who that's their email address. You know, that's all you need to know about Gene. And again, this is kind of my opportunity to combine my two passions, Darwin and beetles, and I consider myself a collector of both. I'm a Darwin collector. I've got over 250 books on Darwin. I can't hardly resist buying anything that's got his name on it. And I think a lot of people put his name in the title just so people like me will buy it. I also have actual signed letters by Darwin and a number of his close confidants that he would share with Wallace, Lyell, Huxley, Bates, Hooker, Gray. This is actually my Hooker letter here. I got a picture of. And then I'm a beetle collector. I've got over 12,000 chrysomelas at my last count. So this is really fun for me to be able to do this. And so what I want to do is I want to follow Darwin's life and how the role beetles played throughout his life. And you say, well, how are you going to do that? And actually, it's pretty easy to do because his life is so documented. You know, back then, of course, everything was written down, and they got mail a couple times a day. And they already have over 14,000 letters, either to or from Darwin. And there's some estimates there could be that many more that were destroyed or some still out there someplace. And then there's the Darwin Correspondence Project I'll talk a little more about. And then, of course, all of his work is online, so everybody has access to virtually everything. And I'm trying to be clever here with the metamorphosis theme, and so I'm going to break down his life into different instars and tell you what happened during these different life stages. So in the first instar, when he was a youth and more of a hobbyist, then second instar, the voyage, and it was a lot of collecting. Third instar was when he started writing this up, and the voyage. And then fourth instar, he's starting to coalesce the ideas that became the origin of species. And then he went into this resting pupil stage where he made the mistake of getting away from beetles and got into barnacles. He actually spent 8 years as a barnacle taxonomist. And then he blossomed and emerged as an adult. And I'm going to give some of the references that he used to beetles in The Origin, Descent of Man, and his autobiography. And the amount of material is staggering on Darwin. In 65, Freeman published a list of the work that he did. And this is 235 pages of just citations of all the books, the articles, the editions, the foreign editions. So this is not the books, this is not the writing, this is just the citations of all the information. And then they started putting out a calendar of correspondence in 85. At that time, they had 13,000 letters. And I believe this was started by a gift from the Darwin family of letters that they had. And then, of course, there's notebooks. And you can see the list of them there. So it's just an unbelievable amount of information. Then something that's close to my heart, the Darwin Correspondence Project, this is where they're taking every letter and they're reproducing every word, every notation in the way it was written. They have footnotes to every person, to every organism. So, I mean, so you can read this. I actually have all of these. The last ones just came out this year. It's like reading his life story, everything he's doing, thinking, where he went, who he, you know, it's just unbelievable how much information that is. And as you've already heard, it's just kind of a quirky, funny thing that they're both, him and Lincoln were born on the same day. And I sense his first kind of beetle influence and natural history started at age 9, where he was a boarder at boarding school, even though, as I understand, it was only a mile away, kind of a dream for all of us, send our kids to boarding school at 9. So at age 14, in this letter, from his younger sister, so he's 14, so his sister, I didn't check how old she was, but obviously she's younger than 14. She's writing him a letter, how does mineralogy, botany, who use those words when you're 12 years old? It's pretty amazing. So there's the first entomology reference there. So now this is his dorm room. This is what dorm rooms looked like then when he went to Christ College. And this was a very intense beetle period in his life. Now his second cousin, William Darwin Fox, who he called his entomological tutor, there was at least 26 letters back and forth between these fellows talking about what they found, where they're going to go next. Here's some drawings. Now, again, this is first instar. He's only 19 years old. Some of the drawings that he made in one of the letters to Fox, and you know, if you're a beetle person, you can tell what family those are, maybe more than that, really coleopterous. And one of the things I want to really convey is the passion that he had for Coleoptera. You can just see in his writing the enthusiasm, and I love the way they make up words like entomologize. I mean, I thought that's really creative. And in the last quote down there, where he's talking about this is the intense collector, this is something I can relate to. It's like, once I get out there, I'm not going to leave anything for anybody else. I'm going to get them all. And as Gene mentioned, one of the first really hallmarks in his career was the first time he saw his name in print when he had a list of 33 beetles that he had collected. I don't know how that moth got in there, but we all have failings, I guess. And then, again, we're still in the first instar here, and it was already affecting his love life, and I thought this was pretty cool, where apparently he was courting or whatever, Fanny Owen, and he must have missed some appointment or didn't show up or backed out of something, and so she was jealous of his dear little beetles, like, you know, are they more important than me? So now we'll go to the second instar. We're going on the voyage. And a lot of people don't realize it was 4 years and 9 months. I think it was only supposed to be 2 years, and it just kept going on and on. And it went over 40,000 miles. But again, as Gene said, most of the time Darwin was on land. I read someplace that they estimated he'd been on horseback for 2,000 miles. So he was out there collecting. Again, another one of his letters. So again, he's out in South America now. He's a letter back to his old collecting buddy and cousin Fox, and he's talking about how he's realizing that he's finding a lot of things that he knows are going to be undescribed in England. Again, you start to feel that passion out there. And a letter from Buenos Aires. You don't really have to read all of this, but the idea that he sees in the European cabinets where everybody wanted the big oh my species, that he was almost consciously getting, I want to collect all the little stuff too, not just the big things. And he knows that these are the things that no one else is going to have, that are going to be undescribed. And at the bottom he said, you know, besides Coleoptera, I've done scarcely anything else. Again, another letter to Fox. This is a couple years later. And he's kind of reminiscing about when they used to go collecting, and this beetle here, this Crux major, keeps coming up. He recounts this story many times through the years, and he's still telling Fox, you're the one that got me into entomology. So now he's back. We're in the third instar, and starting to assemble notes and get together what he's collected. And Sims Covington was Darwin's shooter. There's actually a book just on him. I believe he was like a teenager on the boat that he hired to go out and help shoot and process samples and work with him. And I was amazed at some of the thoroughness and notation that he have. And I've got an example here of two Chrysomela that he collected, and everything's got a number, and where they found it, and the elevation they were at, and describing the vegetation, very complete and very thorough. And in one of his notebooks here, this is when you start seeing where he's using beetles as examples of things. And of course, he was collecting information all the time. That's what he did. And And referring to, if it was just simple creation, why would men have nipples? And why would beetles have fused the elytra with useless wings underneath? It doesn't make any sense to create something that way. And you'll see that repeated many times. And in the journal now, and again, he's only 30 years old, writing up his travels and relating how many beetles he caught on, you know, one day, 68 species. And I think he was almost feeling kind of guilty. He wanted to let people know, well, I got some spiders too. But he was afraid he was going to get accused of spending too much time on his favorite Coleoptera. In the to kind of summarize the role beetles played in the journal, is his journal of researches, he was already noticing patterns here where when he was in the tropics, he was getting fewer carabids, but he's getting more weevils and leaf beetles than he would get back in. No, I think he did it the other way around. Fewer carabids. Anyway, you get the point. And he was starting to hypothesize about beetle behavior and structure. And but it was interesting to me that in the second edition of this, he edited these things out. So I guess if he was afraid he wasn't right on some of these hypotheses. The powers of dispersal was very important to him. He was always trying to determine how things got onto these different islands or from one place to another across the world. And he documented catching a carabid calosoma while they were out at sea. And then these other beetle species, and I listed these for the coleopterists in the crowd that would recognize what they are, where he would see where streams were going out into the sea, and there would be clumps of vegetation or trees and things that he would collect and find beetles that were on them. And this was, well, this is some way they're getting dispersed through over salt water. And again, he was using beetle assemblages to contrast different habitats. And then, again, as you know, islands played a big part in his thinking. And on this one island where he knew that cows had only been there for 33 years, but Phanius, this dung beetle, was in the cow dung. And he's thinking, well, the beetles had to be there before the cow, so maybe they were scavengers to man and were changing their niche there. So now we're going to the fourth instar. You've seen the downhouse before. This is when he's starting to write up his first sketch of his, he called it a sketch of his theory, and then a couple years later put it into an essay. You've seen the sand walk before. My son actually got a chance to visit here and brought me back a rock from there. I don't know if you're supposed to do that, but that's kind of a treasured thing on my bookcase at home. And in this one chapter on the rudimentary organs, this is where he brings up again the why would there be beetles, wingless beetles? And if people know nothing else about Darwin, they've heard the famous story of the beetle collecting. And of having the three, he'd already caught two beetles and he saw another one and put one in his mouth. And most people have read that story from his autobiography, but it was actually in a letter in 1846 is when he actually told the story for the first time. And that Panagias is that crux major. Again, that's that, again, you'll see that repeated. So now we're going to the pupil resting stage. Working on barnacles, and this was a tough time for him. His father died during this period, and one of his treasured children, Annie, died during this time period. So this was, I guess I was trying to be funny about being the pupil resting, but it was a very tough time for him. So now we're going to merge into the adult stage, and Walston, that was mentioned before, actually named this species for Darwin, which has since been revised and changed. But again, I like, this is quite a compliment that we don't have any Darwins in the entomological world or in beetledom. Again, I like how they make up words. And there's actually been two genera and 60 species of beetles named after Darwin. And I've tried to put pictures in that reflect the age of the time period that we're in here. So we're still not at the bearded stage that most people think of Darwin. And another thing that really impressed me is the enthusiasm that he found when his sons got into Beatles. So this is a letter to his oldest son about one of the younger ones frothing at the mouth about Beatles, which is something that he could relate to and I can relate to. And again, here he's still writing to Fox, his entomological tutor and cousin, about his third boy collecting Beatles. And I kind of feel some jealousy in here, whereas his son caught something that he had never caught. It was a prize unknown to him. And so now he's got five sons that are into collecting Beatles. Like, what a dream come true. Of course, they didn't have basketball back then, so if you had five sons that were into Beatles, it's like, what more could you ask for? Knowing him, he probably sent them out to collect for him. And here this is supposedly authored by three of his sons, but we suspect he really wrote this up about some collecting that his sons had done. He put things in obscure journals just to get things in print, I think. But again, you can see how proud he was of his son's collecting. And this is a lot to read, but the point here is this is one of his sons, Francis, that put together the life and letters of his father, and this is where the autobiography chapter came in. And so his son here is telling a story about how, well, you know, we didn't really write this up, but our dad did it. And he could recall how the pleasure of bringing a bottle of dead Beatles to his father and how excited his father would be. So now we get to the origin, and Coleoptera is referenced 33 times in the origin. I'll give you a few of those references here, see the part that it played. These are chapter headings here, and I'm not going to read all of these, but you can see where water beetles, curculio, the sexual selection in the stag beetles, dung beetles. He used dung beetle references a lot. A couple more chapters here. Again, the beetles on islands losing the ability to fly. I'll list some genera here for people that are into those. And again, you can see how the early collecting played a role, and he would recount these stories and references to these later on. Again, the rudimentary organs of the beetles on the islands. Again, you see that again, the jaws of the beetles. And in his conclusion, I thought it'd be really interesting. So now in his concluding chapter, what's really most important to him? Again, the flightless beetles on the islands came out again. Again, you've heard about Bates and a kind of fellow collector, and I had to put in a Chrysomela reference. And since I myself had to do a lot of dissecting of the male dinks, as we call them, how he realized it was related to how this was the only way you could tell some of these species apart. They were so closely related that you'd have to get and dissect the genitalia here to tell them apart. The other major publication that he used Coleoptera was The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex. And it's kind of an odd book because it's really like two books. Part one is The Descent of Man, and part two is the sexual selection part. And there's actually a chapter on beetles. There's a chapter on fish and mammals and all that, and a chapter on beetles. And I just picked out a few of the illustrations that were in there illustrating the sexual dimorphism. And try to work in as many beetle pictures as he can. And a lot of people call this the Darwin beetle. All right, so now we're in the later adult stages. We've got the beard everybody's used to seeing. And he really didn't write an autobiography. What we call his autobiography, he called the Recollections of the Development of My Mind and Character, where he was putting it down kind of to pass down through generation, through his children and grandchildren, so they would know more about their grandfather. And this is then what one of his sons put as in an autobiographical chapter. And so here he's writing about his life. And again, the word beetle appears 10 times. going back to his Cambridge days, nothing was as much fun as collecting beetles. And here he related that story about the three beetles and the one in his mouth, and this is where most of us first heard that story. And I thought this was really interesting. He's referring to some of his colleagues, one that was a well-known archaeologist, one an agriculturist, a chairman of a railway, member of parliament, and I guess the thing that really led to their future success was that they all collected beetles. And here again, it recounts the story of Crux Major and the impression that this made on him. It's amazing when you do read through his life how the impact of these things on him. And here he was talking about that Licinus was one of the beetles that he had not collected, that one of his sons did, and not having seen it for 20 years, but it just brought him right back to that point. So now I want to end with another person's famous colleague impression about Darwin. And so this is in 1908, the 50th anniversary of their joint communication, where they the famous letter that Wallace sent to Darwin of his theory that was just like Darwin's theory, that kind of spurred him on to get it all get it done. And the Institute of Civil Engineers started giving out this first Darwin Wallace medal, and Wallace was still alive then, so he was the first recipient of this medal. And so I guess as part of his acceptance speech, or I guess somehow he made a presentation, he was saying how he was often asked, well, with all the great minds out there, why is it that Darwin and he came up with the solution to this problem? So he thought, well, first of all, the thing that they had in common, that they were both ardent beetle hunters. And if you are a beetle hunter, that when you're confronted with this endless modification, structure, shape, color, surface, it just blows your mind, and you have to come up with some way of explaining and trying to understand this diversity. So to kind of summarize, a thing that struck me is his lifelong passion for beetles. Again, started early. By the time he was 14, he is studying entomology. By 19, he's entomologizing, networking, he's publishing, 19 already. By 21, it's already affecting his love life. Now he goes on the voyage, and here he's seeing the distribution, the patterns of beetles. Then when he starts writing up his thoughts and his experiences, he uses the beetle references many times for the rudimentary organs and the sexual selection. And he was really excited about passing this passion on to his offspring. I don't know whether he did that intentionally or they were just around it so much they just picked it up by osmosis. And then in his autobiography, where you could tell that he never lost his passion, if you wrote up your autobiography, how many times would beetles or whatever you study appear in your autobiography? Here's some of the references and a lot of the photographs I borrowed from the Complete Works Online. Make sure I acknowledge that. And then my other acknowledgments, and again, I want to thank Gene for the invitation, Darwin for everything, and my wife for accepting my dear little beetles and my collecting of Darwin for 35 years. Thank you very much.
All right, well, I'd like to begin by thanking Gene and Carol for inviting me to participate in this symposium. It's been wonderful so far. And I'd also like to begin by saying that, I knew this was going to be a confusing topic to speak on, but I had no idea. So I'm going to give you a disclaimer that I have no intention of offering up the solution to the species problem here today or endorsing one species concept over another. But I do think that I have some interesting things to tell you. Now let's start with the standard story that before Darwin The view that people had of species was influenced profoundly by the thinking of Aristotle and Plato, that species were seen as natural kinds, as created kinds, and that it was an essentialist view where species have essences and they must conform to a typological essentialist view of species. Well, apparently that's maybe not the case. And there's interesting work, Mary Windsor has argued that taxonomists before Darwin were a lot like taxonomists today. In fact, most of them were more interested in practical matters than they were in theoretical purity. So that's an interesting developing idea. There were other peculiar thoughts about in those days, the principle of plenitude, the notion that the world is full of species, that all species that could exist do exist, and that they differ from one another by some sort of minimum degree of difference, and they can be arranged on the scala naturae, from lowest to highest, the great chain of being. It's kind of difficult from this illustration to tell if some of those little blobs are insects or not, but you get the picture. There's a lot of demons and stuff down here, and there's angels and horns up here, and it looks much better at the top. And there's the chain running down the middle. I don't know what that is, the great ball and chain of being here. And you know, we still have echoes of that idea today when we talk about lower insects and lower flies and higher flies and so on. It was a very profoundly influential notion. So we begin with the notion that the species was largely a philosophical issue. And I knew that someone would beat me to this metaphor, but my metaphor is a little bit weirder than Robert's, so I hope you'll stay amused by it. This is the larval stage in the development of species concepts. Then along came Charles Darwin, influenced by the great order Coleoptera, the most speciose group of things on Earth, at least so we think, and in a very good position as a naturalist, as a beetle collector, as a theoretician, to address the question of species. And the usual criticism that you hear is that when Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, he didn't actually talk about the origin of species. He talked a lot about the mechanism of natural selection, but he didn't actually get around to answering the question that was posed by implication in the title of his book. I don't think that's entirely fair. Darwin did have views on species, and some people have defended him in this regard, but those views were certainly subtle. Here's a very familiar quote from The Origin. In short, we shall have to treat species, I'm trying to sound Darwinian here, we have to treat species in the same manner as those naturalists treat genera who admit that genera are merely artificial combinations made for convenience. This may not be a cheering prospect, but we shall at least be free from the vain search for the undiscovered and undiscoverable essence of the term species. And the word essence is very important here, because what Darwin was doing was rejecting that essentialism that had predated the notion that species could change over time. So it went from being, it being species, from being a philosophical concept to being a biological concept, and from being a matter of metaphysics to being a matter of evidence. So as entomologists, we're much more comfortable with evidence than we are with metaphysics. That must be good news. So, ignore the fact that it's a completely different kind of larva, it's a metaphor. The adult, the imago, ecloses from the larva, and we have the evolutionary post-Darwinian species concept. Well, again, that didn't quite happen that way, but over time, we read many authors talking about the development of a polytypic species concept, that species could include things or individuals that look different, but for various reasons are grouped together in the same species. I like, when I think of that, I think of Goliath. I have an interest in the great Goliath beetles of Africa. And you know, you go back and you read the early papers, and the classifications are really quite complicated. Some of these papers are in French and German. And here's a nice little chart here along the top. The columns are pronotal color categories. Along the rows are elytral color categories, and where they intersect, you have an aberration name, and the usual criticism is that the number of aberration names is usually exactly the same as the number of specimens in this person's collection, and that this was the extreme of typology that had to be cleaned up by a more modern view. But you know, it's not, again, it's not quite that way. You go back and you read some of these old papers, and there was a notion of species. There was a notion of subspecies that was developing, of geographic races, and the individuals were grouped according to their aberration, and there were also some understandings of the fact that you could also have hybridization. So it was a populational approach after Darwin, mixed with typology. And certainly among the members of the deep Goliath beetle cult, that typology is still in use. And then along came, of course, the biological species concept championed by Ernst Mayr. I love this picture because he looks like he's leading a group in song. And we all know the lyrics. We could sing along if we wanted, but I won't make you do that. Groups of interbreeding natural populations that are reproductively isolated from other such groups. And a concept that gained a great deal of support and still has relevance in biology today. And because this is an entomological audience, I should mention as well that Mayr gave credit to three entomologists, E.B. Poulsen, Carl Jordan, and Walter Rothschild, who helped to develop that theory, and in turn were inspired by their works on Papilionid butterflies in particular, and notions of reproductive isolation and the importance of reproductive isolation in species and speciation, as well as biogeography. But you know, this metaphor might not be working. I like the idea of a pupil resting stage as well, but in a different way. I mean, it did take a long time between the publication of The Origin and the development of the biological species concept, so perhaps there was a diapause, an internal reordering of things, and we've heard some really interesting historical details of that internal reordering here today. But what emerged wasn't a single beautiful, lovely adult form. It was an array of interesting but unexpected parasitoids. And I mean that in a nice way. I think parasitoids are really wonderful creatures. But what a tremendously confusing situation we face today with all of these different notions about what a species is and how speciation works and how one should recognize species and how one should do classification and so on and so forth. Some people say that perhaps the elusive butterfly of truth, so to speak, to add yet another silly metaphor, looks different in different lights, and so we should be pluralist about our species concepts. We should use different species concepts in different contexts. I think there's some wisdom to that, but I also think that scientists are not that way inclined. We like to believe that there's one reality, and we should have one set of explanations that correspond to that reality. And so we wind up with this situation that Mayr referred to as seemingly utter confusion. And when someone as intelligent and as important as Mayr says that we're dealing with seemingly utter confusion, perhaps we actually are dealing with seemingly utter confusion. One could take two different approaches at this point. You could either go right down to brass tacks and compare the different species concepts and go at it that way, or perhaps look for a common cause for the confusion. Maybe, humor me here, maybe philosophy matters after all. Perhaps there was something that was missed conceptually, and there are certainly a lot of thinkers who think that that this is where the answer lies. I took the oddball step of actually looking in a dictionary of philosophy under the word species, and I found this definition. Any class of individuals sharing common properties and denoted by one common noun. In biology, the class below a genus comprising organisms capable of interbreeding. And then I've added emphasis here. The reality of species is one aspect of the problem of universals. See also natural kinds. Now that's something that I've been interested in for a long time, but I've never actually delved into it. The species concept and the problem of universals. Well, what is that? The problem of universals is deeply and fundamentally weird and foreign to biologists. Let's face it. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Let me attempt to explain it. Here we have a nice little ladybug, a Cyclonida pileata. It belongs to a species. That species has an essence in the pre-Darwinian sense, and that essence has something to do with the universal. It's an unchanging, immaterial, eternal something or other. And there's a fly, a nice little platypeated fly. Let's not talk about species. Let's take a much easier example here. Let's take the fact that they're both orange on part of their body. And the way philosophers have explained this concept to me, the fundamental mystery is, how do they resemble one another with respect to orangeness? How do they both participate in the orange universal? You should see your faces. Holy smokes, what is he talking about? Well, Plato said that these particulars, these substrates, are able to somehow participate, to connect with the ultimate eternal orangeness which exists outside of everyday reality as a universal in the world of forms. Aristotle said, oh, yes, of course that's true, but these universals don't exist outside of ordinary reality. They exist within the particulars. And without without examples of instantiated orangeness, there would be no orange universal. Plato thought no orangeness is independent of whether there are orange universals in the world. Holy moly. Well, as scientists we say, get over it, folks. They're orange because they reflect orange light at about 620 nanometers, and then we go and do whatever we do. But the philosophers are not happy with that answer. They'll come back with something like, well, wait a minute, how do the separate photons that are bouncing off that ladybug and that fly, how do they participate, how do they resemble one another with respect to that wavelength? Get it? Yeah, it's really deep. And if you're a mathematician at this point, you think, wait a minute, this means that, you know, is my science about something, universals, or is it just about stuff that we made up? And it all kind of spills over even to biology. At least that's seems to be the unavoidable conclusion. The notion that universals, if they exist, are immaterial, unchanging, and eternal, more than just names or concepts. And of course there are philosophers who say, no, that's exactly what they are. They are just names or concepts. But then you start wondering about whether they are arbitrary names and concepts, and we don't like arbitrariness in taxonomy and biology. Universals are spooky. I like the word spooky, and again, physicists seem to use the word spooky for peculiar aspects of things like quantum mechanics. So it's neat that we could use the word spooky in biology. I did get in trouble for this picture of my son Benjamin, but the point is that to biologists, it feels like we're having a very narrow and peculiar view forced upon us, in a way. And there's to prove that he was okay after that picture. The good news is, this was new to me, that one can view essences as spooky universals, or one can view essences simply as necessary properties. And I have to remind you here that when we use the word metaphysics, it doesn't necessarily mean New Age weirdness. It simply means the philosophical study of the nature of reality. So we are talking about reality because we're scientists. I took this picture 10 years ago. This place, I looked it up the other day. It's still in business. Crazy. It's in Tucson if you want to go there. I didn't go inside. So now let's come back to the notion of natural kinds, because this is also related. Natural kinds, the common thing you hear is that the identification of natural kinds is a matter of carving nature at the joints, of recognizing the divisions of reality that are real and not arbitrary. So here we have a lovely little stink bug, Paralytus biosylatus, and we think of its species as a sort of natural kind. We think of the group, for example, of all of the red and black stink bugs that were born on a Tuesday as a not natural kind. That's an artificial kind, an arbitrary kind. And philosophers say that natural kinds are things and processes that allow the construction of explanations, and this starts to feel a little bit more comfortable. So we do like to have species names, for examples, that we can use in the construction of explanations and hypotheses when we talk about matters of biology. And there is a way of viewing essences in which they are simply necessary intrinsic properties that make something a member of a kind. And it doesn't sound spooky at all. But not everyone agrees with that. Here's a wonderful quote from a philosopher of science, Daniel Dennett. I'm sure you all recognize his name. "Nothing complicated enough to be really interesting could have an essence." And this discussion of essentialism has been central to a lot of systematic theory and philosophy in recent years. Well, now speaking of complications, let me tell you another personal story. I was preparing this talk, working on it last Saturday, and I had a lot of trouble concentrating because my 11-year-old son was practicing music in the next room with two girls from school, and they have a band. They call themselves the Uncomplicated Complications, and they're not so bad. And while I was listening to this raucous noise, I came upon a reference to a paper that was clearly going to be really interesting to me. A paper called Realism, Essence, and Kind, Resuscitating Species Essentialism. And I realized that the author of this paper was actually the father of the lead singer in this band, and had just been at my house. Now how, you know, if species is about the structure of nature, what's that about it? We've heard a lot of weird coincidence stories here today. So I called up Rob Wilson, and here's Rob Wilson. I asked Rob for a photograph to use in this talk, and he said, well, here's my favorite photograph. He also asked me to tell you that he is a member of the Luxuriant Flowing Hair Club for Scientists. If any of you are also members, he sends his regards. Rob Wilson is a philosopher of science. He's interested in a lot of things, and the way he explained this to me, I asked him, well, what about the problem of universals? He said, who cares about the problem of universals? It doesn't matter. It's a red herring. We don't think that way anymore, John. And he introduced we discussed the concept that he introduced in his paper, the concept of homeostatic property clusters and the homeostatic property cluster view of natural kinds, which originated with a fellow named Richard Boyd at Cornell University. And what they argue is that what you need to recognize a member of a natural kind as a useful category in science is simply enough of the properties in this cluster that he calls homeostatic, because they co-occur frequently because of the structure of nature. You need enough of these properties in the cluster to qualify as a member of the natural kind, that this is a subtle and nuanced form of essentialism, as opposed to the old-fashioned typological, very rigid essentialism, and that it preserves the notion of scientific realism. And I've already mentioned this point here. And I found that really, really interesting. And then I asked him about another paper I'd read by Derek Turner. He talked about universal Darwinism and process essentialism. Apparently you can be an essentialist either with respect to things, like species, or with respect to processes. And he also suggested a notion of clusters of properties, what he called family resemblance. And this is apparently part of Ludwig Wittgenstein's thinking that I haven't read. But there it is. It's essentially the same idea. I shouldn't have said essentially. Pardon me. Scratch that. And I said to Rob, well, Turner comes to the opposite conclusion. He uses these property clusters to say that he's gotten around essentialism, and you're using property clusters to say that you've modified essentialism. You know, which is it? And you're going to love what he said to me. Rob said, well, why don't you ask your audience? Do they want it to be essentialist or don't they? And remind them when you ask them that they have to think about whether essentialism has an essence, and when they recognize or don't recognize essentialism, are they doing it in an essentialistic way? I love talking to philosophers. But have I made my point? I'm not really sure. But I'm very happy with this whole discussion, because it takes away a lot of the angst and motivation that was lurking beneath some of the really angry debates in the history of species concepts. Are we close to a single species concept? Will we recognize it when we get there? This is a small town in Saskatchewan, by the way. Good question. I don't know. I don't know if these ideas that I've just described to you will gain prominence in biology, whether they'll have much of an effect. I think they probably will, but slowly. But certainly a good species concept is going to be one that both makes sense of the patterns in the diversity of life and makes sense philosophically. And to sum up here, it seems to me that Darwin rejected essentialism and put the focus on evidence, not philosophy. But essentialism does not require universals. One can speak of property clusters rather than necessary properties, and this may or may not still qualify as essentialism. And oddly enough, this has been the Darwinian metamorphosis of the species concept. And with apologies for any pointy-headedness that I may have displayed, I'd like to thank these individuals and thank you for your attention. Thanks.
John said he'll entertain questions and give you the definition.
Questions or comments?
Our species is real.
Nope. Carol. How do they sleep? I don't know. I've had trouble sleeping at night. The question is, how do philosophers sleep at night? I've had trouble sleeping at night ever since I started preparing this talk. But, you know, I do think that there's something really quite interesting and profound going on here. I'm not just trying to dodge the subject. I'm really interested in what these guys are saying. All right, well, thank you. Oh, there's a question back there. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what your background is. The question is what's new about this notion of clusters? The straw man of essentialism, the original essentialism, was based on the notion that each individual must possess these necessary defining characteristics in order to belong to the species, and so you have a species that is defined by features that have to be constant. It becomes typological, and the species can't change, because once you define it by those properties, then those properties can't evolve. This view suggests something different. It suggests that you define the species using a whole suite of properties, and that all you need are enough of these properties to qualify as a member of the species, and therefore it does allow for an evolutionary view and so on and so forth. I hope that makes sense. Yes, at the back, yeah. That's an interesting way of putting it. Well, and you know, it's certainly true that entomologists beat him to it in print in the scientific literature as well. So yeah, I'd have to agree with you, Michael. Yeah, the process and pattern issue is that's a very good question, and I'm still trying to wrap my mind around this whole notion of process essentialism and how that changes our views as well. I'm not sure. I know this is going to be interesting, and I know that's an interesting question, but I just haven't been able to roll it through my head yet either. Yeah. That's a dangerous question to ask a large audience.
You get time.
Gene has asked me to ask you, do you have suggestions or ideas of what a species is? Alternatively, would you like to vote and let me report it back to my friend Rob Wilson whether or not we need to worry about essentialism in species?
Call a question.
I think I'm done. Thank you.
For those of you who are just walking in right now expecting to see David Grimaldi, unfortunately his father took a turn for the worse last Friday, and he's had to not show up for today's meeting. I did talk with him, and we're going to have a short presentation of the essence of what he was going to be talking about starting in a couple of minutes, and then we'll have a short break before our next speaker. I'm sure all of you would like me to extend to David, when I talk to him again, that we best wishes to his father at this time. We are right now a minute and a half before we're due to start the next session. What we'll do, we'll have about a 15-minute presentation. We'll take a short break for the audience, because some of you have been here the whole time, and I thank you for that. And then we'll be reconvened in a shortly thereafter. So what we plan to do at this time is to look at the Darwinian metamorphosis of paleoentomology. And since that's Dave's major thesis, and I'm not being a paleoentomologist directly, decided to, in consultation, to look at the whole issue of Darwin's entomological evidence. And indeed, anybody here who teaches a general biology course, and I'm accused of this a lot, of using insects for everything, and I do believe insects can answer everything, and that's just something that John and I will share all the time. As you know, when we talk about the origin of species, we can simplify it to five basic points, if you will, and you all should know those, but those are individuals who try to reproduce as many offspring as possible, that there are limits to that population potential, but only so many male mates, food, etc., thus limits that population. Three, no two individuals look exactly alike, and much of that variation is inherited. Indeed, you can see that by just looking out at this room. No two of you look exactly alike, and the world would really dull if we all did. Four, this variation combined with limits to the population growth in step two results in what Darwin called a struggle for existence, that those individuals who can compete for mates, food, etc., will be more successful in reproducing offspring, and their variations will accumulate in the population. And that Darwin called natural selection, a metaphor which he sometimes wished he hadn't used. I think it's a powerful metaphor, because the general readership of On the Origin of Species accepted the power of artificial selection. Humans could take a plant, and from the same species, humans could create broccoli and cabbage and cauliflower and kohlrabi. You know, and if humans could do that, and we pale in our power compared to nature, you know, if humans could make broccoli, what could nature do? And of course, he wanted his readers to say, well, nature could create human, and although he didn't want to get into that just yet in his book. So he later, though, wished he hadn't used the idea of natural selection, but I think it was a powerful metaphor that helped his readers go along with his thinking in the first four chapters of On the Origin. And then lastly, natural selection will force populations to adapt to local conditions, producing distinct local populations, or the essence of distinct local populations. And the differences will accumulate to where the populations can no longer interbreed, and then you'd have the formation of two new species. Now, Darwin didn't quite say it in that clean of a way. He sort of hedged a little bit on what is a species and what have you, and actually left the question begging. But with all that, that's what we are now talking about in our modern interpretation of Darwin's views. And it turns out you can use entomology to illustrate every single one of them. And if you don't, I hope you would consider doing that. There was a wonderful display at the Smithsonian years ago. And for those of you who had gone to the Smithsonian back in the 70s and 80s, they had a whole hall to evolution. And then something happened in the 80s. I don't know what. Presidential administration came in, but things changed a little bit. And that hall was taken out to put in a giant movie theater, I believe. It's a shame because that hall had some fantastic displays. One of them was to illustrate the first point. If individuals produce as many offspring as possible, then if, as they said in their diorama, if you had one female German cockroach and dropped her Uthika and that all those offspring hatched and they reproduced a maximum, in just a few months, your kitchen could look like this. If your kitchen doesn't look like this, anybody's? If it doesn't look like this, then you're illustrating the second point, that there are limits to that population potential. We do things, like Bob Metcalf told me when I was TAing his entomology IPM class. He said, you clean out the sink, you wash your dishes, you take the trash out in the evening, not in the morning. You know, he had this basic IPM practices of keeping your kitchen not looking like this. I don't know why they took this down. This is a fantastic diorama. 7 million German cockroaches glued to the wall of that kitchen. We talk about that, about differential reproduction and natural selection. Of course, the oft-used example is the peppered moth example. And these are two wonderful photographs of Abyssinia Midgularia that are available on Wikimedia. These are out for domain use for use in lectures and what have you at no charge. And there's been a lot of discussion recently as to whether or not what is the selection pressure that's causing this change in the peppered moth. But if you look at the Excel graph in the corner, whatever the selection pressure is over the last 50 some odd years, the proportion of percentage of black moths has been declining. So it's assumed by a number of authors that there may be some selection going on. Originally it was described that there was a bird predation on these moths, but then it's been thought of, oh, the moths are nocturnal, so what are the birds doing feeding on them? There may be some issues we don't really fully understand, but it is an example of a changing proportions over time. And that's what Darwin was getting at in his point that selection will create a struggle for existence and only so many individuals reproduce the next generation. And then he stated in his last point that selection pressures will be different across geographic ranges, and you'll find populations becoming distinct over their geographic range. And I put this in from my colleague John Acorn, because I was disappointed there were no tiger beetles in your last presentation. But what we see here is a wonderful example of Cicindela tranquillbarica from New Jersey down to Virginia in the middle and Tennessee on the far right. And we're looking at a clinal variation. And this was important to Darwin because, to Darwin, if selection pressures change across the geographic gradient and you find differences accumulating in the population, that's in essence what he's talking about, the kind of change he's describing. He then left the readers say, if you can also show that if conditions, environmental conditions have changed over time, it makes sense that life should have changed over time as well. And indeed, as we'll see when we get into the fossil and paleoentomology, Darwin didn't use fossils to support his ideas very well. In fact, he thought there was a real problem using fossils. And so he basically illustrated organic change with ecological changes, as we see here, clinal variation, not with the paleontological material. An example that Carol brought up earlier, the Rigolitis example in Guy Bush's work, would be an example of speciation patterns that we can use in our classes to drive home the point of where populations can eventually reach a point where they'll no longer interbreed and have the formation of new species. One of the things that Darwin was very keen on, and it relates to John's presentation, is where do you draw that line? Darwin said directly, it's difficult to draw that clear line of demarcation between individual variation, varieties, subspecies, and species. So again, we have tiger beetles here, all collected in the same little coulee in Theodore Roosevelt National Park. If you haven't been there, you should go. The question is, how many species do we have? Is it one variable species? Do we have two, three, four, five? And it turns out there are two species illustrated here. The two on the far right belong to one species, and the four on the left belong to another. And I have actually seen the two species attempting to mate, and we caught the mating pair. And looking at it, turns out they were both male. So there was some problem in that case. But Darwin argued that it was difficult to draw that line of demarcation, and I think that's what we would expect. The fact that we have a problem with the species concept is that species are evolving, they're changing. If they were distinct kinds reproducing after their own kind, we wouldn't be having this discussion today. But the fact they are dynamic and they're changing and it's difficult to figure out what they are is expected from the Darwinian thesis. So let's get into paleoentomology. Well, what would Darwin think of fossil insects and Dave's book that was available a few minutes ago at the Cambridge University book stand? First of all, Darwin felt that fossils were of little use to his thesis, that the fossil record was too incomplete. And let me give you a case study for that. In 1861, a feather was found in Germany named Archaeopteryx. A year later, a nearly complete skeleton was found, purchased eventually by the British Museum. When Darwin found out about that fossil, the public record that he wrote about Archaeopteryx was, quote, "This wonderful bird from the secondary," that's what he called the Mesozoic, "shows how little we know of the geological record." He didn't say, "Yippee, this is proof for me." It showed how little was known of the fossil record and that the record is so incomplete we cannot use it for establishment of his thesis. Now, in private, it was very different. He received the letter from Hugh Falconer describing Archaeopteryx. And as soon as he got this description of this fascinating bird, he wrote back, and as Robert said, they got two, three mails, mail delivery a day. He actually hired the local postman, who actually owned the pub down the road, to deliver mail when it came in. And it's amazing to think about it. He would receive a letter at the morning mail, write a response by noon, and get a response back that evening. That's actually better than some web servers. And in this correspondence that we have between Falconer and Darwin, he asked Falconer directly after Falconer describes this wonderful fossil Richard Owen was describing, who eventually got the right hand, the left hand mixed up and all these other problems. He said, "Can you tell me about the digits, the fingers? Are they cloven? Were the fingers separate?" Because in 1860, he had predicted to Charles Lyell that someday, if a fossil bird was ever found in the Mesozoic, that it would be found with the fingers cloven. He also went on to say, that's admitting prophecy, and if you admit to prophecy, that's Stan about to rejecting natural selection. And so, even though he then got the letter back that night from Falconer, they were separate, and he was all excited, he still would not come out and say that Archaeopteryx was, in record in his writings, that Archaeopteryx was evidence of his work. In private, though, he was very, very different in his views. In private, he wrote to Dana, quote, "This wonderful bird from the lower secondary is a grand case for me." So he understood what it meant, but he could not come out and negate his argument in the two chapters with regard to paleontological evidence. So how would Darwin feel about the evidence that Dave presented in his most recent book on the evolution of insects? And what we want to do is highlight some of the fossils that we're going to be discussed in detail today. And if you haven't had a chance to look into these things, we've got some neat stuff out there to consider. This happens to be a panhexapod. It is an early Devonian panhexapod. It's a clade. That's the clade that includes all hexapodal organisms. This happens to be a marine animal. It has a single pair of antennae, but the abdomen has not been reduced to 11 segments, so we're not calling it the ancestral insect by any means. There is a loosely formed head, thorax with three distinct walking legs, and then smaller appendages on all the abdominal segments. You'll notice that there are distinct appendages of the mouth parts, further discussion of this in Grimaldi's book. The fact that this is marine gives some congruence to the recent molecular evidence that suggests that the insects evolved from freshwater crustacea. And if that's the case, then this is now giving us new insight into the origin of the group that we're celebrating with this conference. course, the oldest true insect fossil is from the Rhynia Chert in Scotland. It's in the early Devonian, from the very earliest layers of the Devonian. What we have here is the photograph of the fossil at the top with the drawing reconstruction at the bottom. And all we have is the head capsule, and we got the mandibles, that's what's sclerotized and preserved, and the dicondylic mandibles, which is interpreted now as evidence that this was indeed insect. And this is our oldest fossil insect, and all we can say is it had dicondylic mandibles. There's also some bits of cuticle from the Devonian that have been examined as well, but we don't have that wonderful full proto-insect or new insect to look at. There's still work to be done in the Devonian, obviously. What's thought by many to be the more primitive insect groups include things like Monera, which is the old name for this group. This has now been placed in the Archaeonatha. It's a monocondylic apterous insect from the Carboniferous. The group has one long single telson, elongated palpi, three walking legs, and like the relatives still living with us today, the Archaeonatha at the top and the Thysanerthmon, we still see the rudimentary appendages of the cilia, if you will, that are found in the abdominal segments. And a nice holdover of a rudimentary structure. For Darwin, rudimentary structures were the silent letters of evolution. He said, if you look at the silent letters of words, they tell you nothing about the pronunciation, but they will give you inferences on the origin of that word. And he felt that these rudimentary structures and organisms were critical in understanding the evolution of various groups. Within some of the other groups that we're familiar with, some of the Paleozoic mayflies had four equal-sized wings in contrast to the smaller hindwing that we see in mayflies living today. And indeed, you can look at some variation fossils showing that decline in apterous condition. One of my favorite groups are the three large groups from the extinct orders from the Paleozoic. This is Paleodictyoptera with the wonderful paranodal flaps, and we could have a whole symposium just on the origin of wings and whether these things figure into that process or not. Megasecoptera, which has modifications of those paranodal lobes and little spiky structures you see here in this reconstruction, and Diaphanopteroidea, which based on how the fossil was preserved, looked like it might have evolved its own form of Neoptery, but not in the same Neoptery that we see in the insects that are extant today. These three orders, now extinct, all had sucking mouth parts. And in the work of Lamadera, we find in some of the cobalt peels evidence of what looks like insect feeding in plant tissues of the same era. The one on the far left shows the long proboscis directed anteriorly. An interesting group described in a little more detail in Grimaldi's book is the Gyroptera. This is another group that had paranodal flaps, and it's now being interpreted as being ancestral to the Odinates. The charge and the mission that we had for his presentation was to give us essentially the entomological version of Archaeopteryx. And it wasn't pick one, we had lots of them. And that's the take-home lesson. This is an interesting group looks like a stem group of the related to the Odinates. Of course, the Protodonates, that wonderful group where we had these 35, 39-inch wingspanned dragonfly-like things are quite impressive as well in the Coal Age forest. Another extinct order. And indeed, some of the work Frank Carpenter in the past looked at the origin of the evolution of the unique venation that defines the Odinates, the Odinata, in this case the dragonfly wing here, and you can see at the oft-illustrated example showing how the different wing veins can be found throughout the Carboniferous, eventually evolving the arculus and the triangle. Again, we have a wonderful sequence of fossils to help fill in some very interesting questions we have in the paleontological record. The Proto-Orthoptera is now being originally, when I was studying this with Ellis McLeod at Illinois, this was almost like a garbage can group that just filled everything from this group, all these chewing and mouth parts insects with paranodal flaps as well, lobes and so on. It's now being restricted now as an ancestral group to the stoneflies, and we're seeing a number of fossil forms that are very indicative of stonefly ancestral-like forms that what we'd expect it to look like if our preconceived ideas are present. Notice a number of these have these paranodal flaps, and that's a common theme we're beginning to see back in the Carboniferous. Cockroaches are really neat. You often go to if you go to the Field Museum, as I took my students just 2 weeks ago, you can see these wonderful big cockroach models on the sides of lepidodendron and the wonderful coal-age forestings. But a lot of these carboniferous cockroaches are very different indeed from the roaches we have today. Notice it has a long ovipositor, much like we see with the Orthoptera. Indeed, as we look at some of the other fossil cockroaches, we see presence of a very long needle-like ovipositor. So some people have called cockroaches living fossils, but in reality, we do see some significant morphological change in the cockroach evolution over the last 300 million years. The Titanoptera is a rather an interesting enigmatic extinct order of insects. It's got that very weird wing venation that you see at the top, very long antennae, raptorial forelegs, chewing mouth parts, a nice good anal lobe on the hind wing. It's been interpreted by some that we look at that weird venation on the wings, that these things might have produced sounds, might have been insects who are capable of essentially creating the noise of the coal-age forests of the past. Not much else we can say about these, except that the speculation looks like it's interpreted that this unusual pattern on the wings is for sound production. Another group that might come into play is a early Cretaceous basal praying mantis, showing the raptorial forelegs, but we don't have the elongated pronotum yet, and so it fits within that range of these insect species evolving into the various orders we see now, but again showing more morphological change over the last, in this case, 100 million years. Protodelatroptera was originally thought to be some kind of a beetle-like thing. It's now looked at as the possible ancestors to the earwigs. Before, of course, the four wings have been shortened into the elytra we're seeing now. But based on wing venation, it's now being getting a re-examination of its status in the paleontological world. Calinurodia, another nondescript, long cursorial leg, long antennae, chewing mouth part, membranous winged order. Little can be said about their biology, because all we have are just a few of these specimens. We're still relying on Frank Carpenter's requirement that you must have the head, the mouth parts, all three legs, at least one of all three legs, and the wings before you can name an extinct order and have it stand up. There's well over, maybe close over 100 orders of insects, fossil insects that have now been described, and we're down to a much more smaller number. The Glossolitrodia may be an artificial group. I put up the wing veins. I've not been able to find a good illustration of what the whole insect probably would look like. It is interpreted by many to have been a stem group of the Neuroptera. There is a lot of discussion in the literature about whether these things are holometabolous or still hemimetabolous or parametabolous, depending on the definition you wish to use. The diagnostic feature is that very large precostal area on the wing that lets them stand out as a unique order. Myomoptera, mostly known from wing fragments. There are, of course, some fossils of the legs, showing the legs and what have you, but no complete specimen. These have been widely interpreted as maybe our oldest holometabolous insects, very small. I've seen them listed back in the 50s. They were thought to be ancestral to the Homoptera, and then the recent literature has talked about them being maybe a proto-Hymenoptera. More needs to be found before we can ascertain what these things are about. One group we have to talk about because it's part of the popular literature are the beetles. And again, Darwin would have been very fond of the beetles. A number of these are beetles from England, fossil insects from the Jurassic in England. And these are extinct representatives of the Archaeostomata. And what they show, which I find fascinating when you look at the fossils, is that you can see the evolutionary transition to the elytra. Notice how the wing veins are filling in, the cross veins are getting thicker, and you can still make out the actual wing veins that you'd find in a membranous insect. And so as more cuticle was being placed into the wing, giving us a typical elytra, you can see in these fossils, these things did evolve from insects with membranous wings. And that's a nice story to tell. They're also, if we were going to do the insects of Jurassic Park, 9 out of every 10 fossil insects from the Jurassic belonged to this group. So the late Michael Crichton, sorry that he passed recently, done the insects of Jurassic Park, it would have been these. That would have been a lot of fun to see. And the last one I want to let you with the story of the excitement going on in paleoentomology. This is an early mosquito-like scorpion fly. The fossil scorpion flies are amazing. We've got some evidence of fossil scorpion flies with fully functional four wings down to reduced hind wings, getting almost to the point where it's hard to figure out, are we talking about a scorpion fly or early true fly, or, and there are some scorpion flies that maybe have been described as four-winged flies. Really neat thing. This one I could not resist. It's a mosquito-like scorpion fly, which some have interpreted as possibly an ectoparasite on pterosaurs, one of the more common fossils found in the layers in which these things were found. So if this doesn't whet your appetite for paleoentomology, get Dave's book, and I'm going to hope that we get him back in the future for the symposium. Thank you very much.